Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Thursday, January 13th reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. King Soopers. Workers go on strike. Picket lines go up outside stores across the metro area, by Judith Kohler and Taylor Shaw. 40-year high. Consumers, Fed, Biden feel pressure with inflation, by Christopher Rugeber. Hospitalizations. State tops November peak, but fewer being treated primarily for COVID-19, by Meg Wingerter. COVID-19. Kids lagging vaccination rates called a gut punch, by Leslie Tanner, and following up with miscellaneous articles. King Soopers. Workers go on strike. Picket lines go up outside stores across the metro area, by Judith Kohler and Taylor Shaw, The Denver Post. Thousands of grocery workers started walking the picket lines at King Soopers stores from Boulder to Parker early Wednesday morning, a day after the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7 rejected the company's latest contract offer. With no movement on contract negotiations, which started in October, leading up to Saturday's expiration of the current deal, the threat of a strike increased. Once the union spurned Tuesday's proposal, which included wage increases and health care benefits, as well as bonuses ranging from $2,000 to $4,000 for ratification of the contract, workers planned Wednesday morning's walkout. Our original offer on the table was $148 million in wage increases. We raised that to $170 million, which is the largest wage increase in the history of King Soopers and City Market, Joe Kelly, president of Kroger-owned King Soopers and City Market, said Tuesday. There was no movement on contract negotiations Wednesday. When the union called the strike, UFCW Local 7 president Kim Cordova said it would last 3 weeks. About 15 people were on the picket line Wednesday morning at a King Soopers store on South Colorado Boulevard in Denver. Several cars drove into the parking lot, slowed down, and gave a thumbs up or honked when the driver saw the picket signs and drove away. Union members had flyers they would hand to customers entering the store that suggested alternative places to shop, such as Safeway and Sprouts. Carrie Noden, a 31-year King Soopers employee, said business was slow for a typical weekday. "The parking lot is usually much more full," Noden said as she stood outside with fellow union members. Inside, there was a handful of shoppers, and some workers were standing and talking to each other. As the morning went on, business did pick up. Some people weren't persuaded to support the strike and shop elsewhere. A man who wouldn't give his name told employee Paul Hoffmaster that if King Soopers raises wages, the money will come out of customers' pockets. At a King Soopers store on East Mississippi Avenue in Aurora, Talisa Canche and Deshaun Garcia rolled out two shopping carts full of food and unloaded them into the back of their SUV. They said they support the striking workers, but the store is convenient for them and has better deals than other stores, although they complained they had to do some of their own bagging because there weren't many workers in the store. "I see where they're coming from, but it's not going to keep me from shopping," Concha said. "Working in retail, customer service gets hard. It gets frustrating," Garcia said. "But at the end of the day, we've got families to feed. We have to go where they have better deals." However, Gary Enriquez, a regular customer at the Aurora store, said he'll shop everywhere else around here but here, during the strike. He and his daughters, Aracile, 4, and Ariel, 3, pulled a little wagon full of snacks along the picket line, handing out bags of potato chips, cookies, and drinks to the striking workers. Laura Reitel got a round of thank you from workers on the picket line at a King Soopers on South Pierce Street in Littleton when she said she would buy her coffee and creamer elsewhere. "I want to support them because this is my neighborhood grocery store," said Reitel, who made the decision after talking to the employees. Ardita Flores was among the workers walking the picket line at the South Pierce Street store in Littleton. She said she makes $18 an hour as a part-time employee and doesn't get benefits. Although Flores says she's lucky because of her family's financial situation, other part-time workers struggle to get by. "I'm out here because I see my coworkers who are not able to eat," Flores said. A report titled "Hungry at the Table," commissioned by 4 units of the UFCW and released Tuesday, said 78% of the employees at Kroger-owned stores in Colorado and 2 other states who responded to a survey reported not having enough food to eat. Kroger called the report paid for by the union misleading, contending it relies on flawed data. The company said an analysis it commissioned and released Wednesday shows 85,000 hourly employees of the company stores in California, Colorado, Oregon, and Washington are more highly compensated than employees working for its peers. Providing benefits to employees would be better than the one-time bonuses King Soopers has proposed, Flores said. King Soopers has urged the union to let members vote on the company's latest contract offer. "We have a member-led bargaining committee of over 70 King Soopers employees who decide what we vote on, and they decided the offer on the table isn't any good," Joshua Haymore, who works at the store on South Colorado Boulevard, said. Cordova said the union is willing to resume talks, but King Soopers hasn't provided information it needs on wages, pensions, health care, and other items to evaluate the proposal despite repeated requests for the data. And King Soopers' latest offer contained unacceptable provisions, Cordova added, including restrictions on workers' ability to work overtime, shortening the time for workers who are on leave of absence, and the refusal to address proposals to end a 2-tier pay structure in the contract. "Wages are a major concern for union members." Barbara Hunter, a meat clerk who has worked at King Soopers for more than 2 years, said her 16-year-old daughter makes more money, earning $16 an hour compared to Hunter's $13.60 an hour at a store on South Wadsworth Boulevard in Littleton. Employees blame staffing shortages on low wages. King Soopers has acknowledged having about 2,100 openings in King Soopers and City Market stores in the region, but said industries nationwide are grappling with labor shortages. Safety was another big topic for workers walking the picket lines Wednesday. They said the controls and sanitation efforts put in place when the pandemic hit in 2020 largely have been dropped. They said the company doesn't enforce mask mandates for the public, and employees are left to deal with irate customers on their own. Noden, who took part in the last King Soopers strike in 1996, said working during the pandemic has been stressful. She said the company provided security guards early during the COVID-19 outbreak, but along with hazard pay, pulled the guards after a couple of months. The union has requested armed security guards to deal with any altercations and what it says is rising crime in areas where the stores are, as well as thefts and robberies in the stores. 3 security guards were standing outside the King Superstore on South Colorado Boulevard on Wednesday morning. "Once we told them we were going on strike yesterday, we had a full-time security guard in there from the moment I walked in the door until I left," Haymore said. "The minute we're going on strike, your product, your stuff, might be in jeopardy. That's when you're going to bring in security." 2 security guards were at the front entrance of a King Superstore on South University Boulevard in Highlands Ranch. Workers on the picket line were gathered on the other side of the street. Susie Vidger, a 17-year employee, said workers were told by store managers that they couldn't be in front of the store because it was private property. We were told if we picketed across that way, we would be arrested, Vidgar said. We also were told today that there was a possibility if we parked in the parking lot, we could be towed. The strike affects the King Super stores where the union's contracts expire January 8th. The stores are in the following cities: Denver, Arvada, Aurora, Boulder, Broomfield, Centennial, Commerce City, Edgewater, Englewood, Evergreen, Federal Heights, Glendale, Golden, Greenwood Village, Highlands Ranch, Lakewood, Littleton, Louisville, Thornton, Westminster, and Wheat Ridge. The union's contracts with other King Supers and City Market stores expire later in January and in February. The union is still negotiating with Albertsons, which owns Albertsons and Safeway stores in the state. The union filed a federal lawsuit against King Supers in late December, accusing the company of unfair labor practices. King Supers filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board Tuesday, accusing the union of the same thing. King Supers has been advertising for temporary replacement workers, and the company announced Wednesday morning that its stores will remain open through the strike. Union members from across the country have traveled to Colorado to support striking workers, Cordova said. The last strike by grocery workers in Colorado was in 1996. Union members at King Supers walked off the job, and Safeway and Albertsons eventually locked out union members. The strike lasted 42 days. 40-year high. Consumers, Fed, Biden feel pressure with inflation, by Christopher Rugeber, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. Inflation jumped at its fastest pace in nearly 40 years last month, a 7% spike from a year earlier that is increasing household expenses, eating into wage gains, and heaping pressure on President Joe Biden and the Federal Reserve to address what has become the biggest threat to the U.S. economy. Prices rose sharply in 2021 for cars, gas, food, and furniture as part of a rapid recovery from the pandemic recession. Vast infusions of government aid and ultra-low interest rates helped spur demand for goods, while vaccinations gave people confidence to dine out and travel. As Americans ramped up spending, supply chains remained squeezed by shortages of workers and raw materials, and this magnified price pressures. The Labor Department reported Wednesday that a measure of inflation that excludes volatile food and gas prices jumped 5.5% in December, also the highest in decades. Overall inflation rose 0.5% from November, down from 0.8% the previous month. Price gains could slow further as snags in supply chains ease, but most economists say inflation won't fall back to pre-pandemic levels anytime soon. U.S. inflation measures show no sign of easing, said James Knightley, chief international economist at the financial services company ING. It hasn't been this high since the days of Thatcher and Reagan. We could be close to the peak, but the risk is that inflation stays higher for longer. High inflation isn't only a problem for the U.S. In the 19 European countries that use the euro currency, inflation rose 5% in December, compared with a year earlier, the biggest increase on record. Companies large and small are adapting as best they can. Nicole Pomaget, a bakery owner in the Minneapolis area, said she plans to raise prices for cookies because of surging ingredient costs. Her basic cookies were priced at 99 cents each, while premium versions were selling for $1.50 each. But Pomaget said she will have to jack up the prices of her basic cookies to the premium price. We have to make money, she said. We don't want to lose our customers, but I think we might. Businesses struggling to hire have hiked pay, but rising prices for goods and services have eroded those income gains for many Americans. Lower-income families have felt it the most, and polls show that inflation has started displacing even the coronavirus as a public concern. The U.S. hasn't seen anything like it since the early 1980s. Back then, Fed Chairman Paul Volcker responded by pushing interest rates to painful levels. The prime rate for banks' best customers hit 20% in 1980, and sent the economy into a deep recession. But Volcker succeeded in taming inflation that had been running at double-digit year-over-year levels from much of 1979 to 81. High inflation has put President Biden on the defensive. His administration, echoing officials at the Fed, initially suggested that price increases would be temporary. Now that inflation has persisted, Biden and some congressional Democrats have begun to blame large corporations. They say meat producers and other industries are taking advantage of pandemic-induced shortages to drive up prices and profits. But even some left-of-center economists disagree with that diagnosis. On Wednesday, the president issued a statement arguing that the drop in gas prices in December and a smaller increase in food costs showed progress. One trend experts fear is a wage price spiral. That happens when workers seek more pay to offset higher costs, and then companies raise costs further to cover that higher pay. On Tuesday, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell told a Senate panel that he has yet to see evidence that wages are broadly driving up prices across the economy. The biggest driver of inflation, according to economists, are mismatches between supply and demand. Used car prices have soared more than 37% over the past year because a shortage of semiconductors has prevented auto companies from making enough new cars. Supply chain constraints have driven furniture prices nearly 14% higher over the past year. Shoppers are feeling the pinch all around them, from the gas station to the grocery store. Vicky Bernardo Hill, 65, an occupational therapist in Gaithersburg, Maryland, said she no longer throws extra canned food, boxes of cereal, or bakery items into her shopping cart at the Giant food store. "I am trying to stick to my list and buying things that are on sale," said Hill. Because she couldn't find a good deal on a used car, Hill recently bought a new Mazda, spending $5,000 more than she had planned. Inflation could ease as the Omicron wave fades and as Americans shift more of their spending to services such as travel, eating out, and movie going. That would reduce the demand for goods and help clear supply chains. But some higher prices, such as rents, could prove to be stickier. Rental costs, which have accelerated since summer, rose 0.4% in December, the third consecutive monthly increase. That's significant because housing costs make up one-third of the government's consumer price index. Powell told Congress that if it becomes necessary to fight high inflation more aggressively, the Federal Reserve is prepared to accelerate the interest rate hikes it planned to begin this year. The Fed's benchmark short-term rate, now pegged near zero, is expected to be bumped up at least three times this year. Rate increases would make borrowing for a home or car more expensive and therefore help to cool off the economy. Some economists and members of Congress fear the Fed has acted too slowly to head off inflation and that this eventually could force even sharper rate increases that could damage the economy. Republicans in Congress and even some liberal economists say Biden deserves at least some of the blame for high inflation, arguing that the financial rescue package he pushed through Congress in March added significant stimulus to an already strengthening economy. Hospitalizations. State tops November peak, but few being treated primarily for COVID-19. By Meg Wingerder, The Denver Post. Colorado exceeded the Delta wave's peak for COVID-19 hospitalizations Wednesday, but fewer people hospitalized during the current Omicron surge are being treated primarily for symptoms from the virus. Although estimates vary widely on how many patients just happen to test positive after being admitted. State epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said 1,577 people were hospitalized statewide with confirmed COVID-19 as of Wednesday afternoon, which is one more hospitalization than when the Delta wave peaked on November 23rd. At the worst point of the pandemic, in early December 2020, 1,847 people were hospitalized with the virus. Our hospitals obviously continue to be under significant strain, she said during a news briefing. But the fast-spreading Omicron variant that has sent new infections skyrocketing in Colorado is less likely to cause severe illness than the Delta variant, which drove the state's fifth wave. Colorado has more beds available in intensive care units than it did during that wave, said Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander. An average of 91% of intensive care beds and 93% of general hospital beds statewide were in use over the past week. Herlihy said the state estimates about 65% of current COVID-positive patients are in the hospital because they have the virus, with COVID-19 either contributing to the hospitalization or playing no role at all for the others. In previous waves, 80% to 90% of patients who had COVID-19 were hospitalized because of complications from the virus, she said. UC Health and Denver Health have reached almost the opposite conclusion about why the majority of their COVID-19 patients are there, reporting 60% to 65% came to the hospital for some other reason and were then found to have the virus. It's possible that those hospitals are seeing a different mix of patients than those in other parts of the state, or that they and the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment are using different methods of classifying patients. Whether a hospitalization would have been avoided but for COVID-19 isn't always easy to parse. A person who broke their leg skiing and happened to test positive with an asymptomatic infection is clearly an incidental hospitalization. A person with diabetes who comes in with the blood sugar crisis is harder to label because viral infections can exacerbate chronic conditions. Even when the virus isn't the primary reason someone sought care, it creates difficulties because those patients must be isolated from others, and anyone caring for them needs to don full protective equipment before going in, Herlihy said. It also may cause complications that keep a person in the hospital longer, she said. In many cases, COVID-19 is continuing to complicate their hospitalization, extend their hospitalization, she said. Models project the current surge could peak as soon as this weekend, with about 2,100 people with COVID-19 hospitalized, Herlihy said, although an outside scenario shows the wave peaking later, with more than 3,000 hospitalizations. So far, the percentage of tests coming back positive, generally the first weather vane to turn when a wave of COVID-19 is ramping up or coming to its end, has continued to increase, averaging 30% over the past week. There's also no sign cases are dropping, with more than 12,000 new infections reported over the previous 24 hours on Wednesday. In previous waves, the positivity rate would fall first, followed by cases, and a week or so later, hospitalizations. The state is looking at local data, as well as what happened in South Africa, the United Kingdom, and other states, Herlihy said. New York City just hit its peak in cases, and Colorado can learn from how long it takes hospitalizations to start declining there, she said. In December 2020, at the pandemic's peak for hospitalizations, conditions were different. Businesses were operating under significant capacity restrictions, and Colorado had a statewide mask mandate in place. But the virus was less transmissible. In November 2021, during the peak of the Delta wave, the restrictions were over, and a committee was preparing guidelines for implementing crisis standards in case Colorado should have to ration care. Colorado currently has crisis standards in place to allow hospitals and emergency medical providers to stretch their staffing in ways that could mean less than optimal care for patients. But there's no sign that rationing care is on the horizon, Bookman said. He noted that frontline healthcare workers have been dealing with the pandemic for almost 2 years. They're going to need to surge again, he said. COVID-19. Kids' lagging vaccination rates called a gut punch, by Lindsay Tanner, the Associated Press. Distrust, misinformation, and delays because of the holidays and bad weather have combined to produce what authorities say are alarmingly low COVID-19 vaccination rates in U.S. children ages 5 to 11. As of Tuesday, slightly more than 17% were fully vaccinated, more than 2 months after shots became available to the age group. While Vermont is at 48%, California is just shy of 19%, and Mississippi is at only 5%. Vaccinations among the elementary school set surged after the shots were introduced in the fall, but the numbers have crept up slowly since then, and Omicron's explosive spread appears to have had little effect. The low rates are very disturbing, said Dr. Robert Murphy, executive director for the Institute for Global Health at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. It's just amazing. Parents who hesitate are taking an enormous risk and continuing to fuel the pandemic, Murphy said. Hospitalizations of children under 18 with COVID-19 in the U.S. have climbed to their highest levels on record in the past few weeks. Many have other conditions made worse by COVID-19, although many aren't sick enough to require intensive care. The low vaccination rates and rising hospitalizations are a gut punch, especially when we've been working so hard to keep these kids well, said Dr. Natasha Burgert, a pediatrician in Overland Park, Kansas. The vaccines have proved highly safe and effective at reducing the risk of severe illness, hospitalization, and death. Overall, 63% of Americans are fully vaccinated. Among children 12 to 17, the rate is 54%. COVID-19 shots for young children have been authorized in at least 12 countries. In Canada, where Pfizer shots were cleared for ages 5 to 11 in November, just 2% are fully vaccinated. Snowstorms, tornadoes, and other heavy weather in December are believed to have slowed the pace of vaccination in the U.S., along with the busy holiday season. Also, some parents are distrustful because the vaccine is so new, and many have other concerns. Chicago mother Kendra Shaw has resisted shots for her two school-aged children, saying she worries about possible risks and isn't convinced the benefits are worth it. But this week, her 10-year-old daughter pleaded to get vaccinated so she wouldn't miss school, and her soon-to-be 7-year-old asked for his shots so he could have a big birthday party. Shaw scheduled their first doses for Wednesday but said, "I'm really on the fence." Daniel Kotzen of Denver said he is convinced he made the right decision not to vaccinate his 5-year-old daughter and 7-year-old son because most Omicron cases seem to be mild. They are essentially at no risk of harm, so I really don't understand the reason to vaccinate them, he said. Doctors say that kind of thinking is misguided and part of the problem. It's true, kids in general do better than adults with COVID, said Dr. Elizabeth Murray, a pediatric emergency medicine physician in Rochester, New York, and a spokeswoman for the American Academy of Pediatrics. But not too sick can still mean miserable with fevers and muscle aches for a week. It can also mean Miss C or long COVID. Miss C or multisystem inflammatory syndrome is a rare but serious condition linked to COVID-19 that can affect many organs and typically requires hospitalization. Authorities don't think Omicron is making children and adults more seriously ill than other variants, and they say hospitalization rates are up partly because it is so much more contagious. Some children have been admitted for conditions such as lung disease, diabetes, and sickle cell disease that have worsened because of an Omicron infection, doctors say. Dr. Jesse Hackrell, a pediatrician in Pomona, New York, said that at least 25% of his patients ages 5 to 11 are vaccinated, but that after an initial rush in the fall, the numbers have dwindled. "It's a tough sell," he said. "We're not ready," is a common comment, Hacknell said. "When I ask, 'What are you waiting for?' I get kind of a shrug. I've had a few say, 'We're not going to be the first million. We'll wait and see what happens.'" Hackel, frustrated, said the government's vaccination campaign is clearly struggling against misinformation and pseudoscience, the likes of which he has never seen before in his 40-plus years as a pediatrician. He said the government needs to get tough and mandate the shots. "If we could get every kid vaccinated across the board, it would go a long way. It wouldn't end the pandemic, but it would end the severe disease, Hackel said. It could help turn the virus into nothing more serious than the common cold, and we can deal with that. COVID-19 report. Virus was the leading cause of death among U.S. police officers in 2021 by Derek Bryson Taylor, the New York Times Company. For the second year in a row, COVID-19 was the leading cause of death for U.S. law enforcement officers, according to a report released Tuesday by the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. A total of 458 officers died in the line of duty in the country last year, making it the deadliest year in more than 90 years. And a 55% increase from 2020, according to preliminary data compiled by the organization. Of those, it found that 301 federal, state, tribal, and local law enforcement officers had died because of COVID-19. It has been reported to NLEOMF that these officers have died due to direct exposure to the virus during the commission of their official duties, the report said. Felony assaults were responsible for the death of 84 officers last year, including 62 officers killed with firearms, the report said. 58 were killed in traffic-related incidents while working the roadways. The number of deaths from firearm assaults and traffic-related fatalities had risen from the previous year. The remaining deaths were attributed to reasons such as heart attacks, strokes, and 9/11-related illnesses. The report said. Other officers were killed in beatings, drownings, and stabbings. One officer was killed by floodwaters, and another was killed in a tornado. In the 3 decades before the pandemic, the organization's annual tally of officers killed in the line of duty surpassed 200 only twice, in 2001 and 2007. The last time it went above 300 was in 1930. While hundreds of COVID-related officer deaths were identified, the report is preliminary, and its authors expected that agencies had yet to report a significant number of them. Law enforcement officers nationwide continue to be exposed to the COVID-19 virus in the course of their daily assignments, it said. Therefore, the number of line-of-duty deaths is sadly ever increasing. Last fall, it was reported that more than 460 U.S. law enforcement officers had died from COVID-19 infections tied to their work since the start of the pandemic. With no comprehensive accounting of how many officers had been sickened with the virus, departments from coast to coast reported large outbreaks in the ranks. Vaccinations, which have proven to be effective in preventing severe illness and death, have remained a hard sell for some officers. In recent months, as local governments began implementing vaccine mandates for workers, some police officers and law enforcement unions have pushed back, threatening resignations and legal action. In October, New York City's largest police union sued over the city's vaccine mandate. The Police Benevolent Association of New York said it opposed a vaccine mandate for officers that does not allow an option for being tested weekly instead of being vaccinated. A federal judge this week dismissed a lawsuit filed by several Los Angeles police officers who had sued over the city's vaccine mandate. Army raises bonuses for recruits to $50,000 by Lolita C. Baldor, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. The Army, for the first time, is offering a maximum enlistment bonus of $50,000 to highly skilled recruits who join for 6 years, the Associated Press has learned. As the service struggles to lure soldiers into certain critical jobs during the continuing pandemic, Major General Kevin Vereen, head of the Army Recruiting Command, said shuttered schools and the competitive job market over the past year have posed significant challenges for recruiters. So heading into the most difficult months of the year for recruiting, the Army is hoping that some extra cash and a few other changes will entice qualified young people to sign up. We are still living the implications of 2020 and the onset of COVID, when the school systems basically shut down, said Vereen. We lost a full class of young men and women that we didn't have contact with face-to-face. 2 years of the pandemic has made it more difficult to recruit in schools and at public events, and the competition for quality workers has intensified as young people weigh their options. Some, Vereen said, are taking what he calls a gap year and are making the decision that they don't necessarily need to work right now. The annual recruiting goal fluctuates as currently serving soldiers decide whether to reenlist or leave. In the past 2 years, as the pandemic raged, many decided to stay in, lessening the pressure on recruiting to help keep the Army at its full strength of 485,000. Last year's recruiting goal was 57,500, and Vereen said it will be about the same this year. To entice recruits, those who sign up for a 6-year enlistment in one of several high-demand career fields can get bonuses that total as much as $50,000. Given the high standards, it will be difficult for many to qualify. The final figure depends on when they agree to ship out for training, if they already have critical skills, and if they choose airborne or ranger posts. Certain careers, such as missile defense crew, special forces, signals, intelligence, and fire control specialists who coordinate battlefield weapons operations, often come with the maximum bonuses. But other key jobs include infantry, intelligence analyst, combat medic specialist, military police, combat engineer, and several others. And those may change every month based on available spots in the training pipeline and other service needs. Until now, the Army has offered a maximum bonus of $40,000. Sergeant First Class Mary James has been working as a recruiter in Ohio since November 2020, and she said the early months when COVID-19 was surging and there were no vaccines were challenging. It's gotten better, and she said the higher bonuses will help her. Money isn't always the first thing they talk about, but it does come into play, said James, who has been in the Army for 15 years. It will be exciting to see what the return is on that. You know, I think it does put us in one of the top-tier levels of competitive businesses. Voting rights. Democrats plan to fast-track bill, Speeding Up Showdown, by Carl Hulse, The New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. Moving quickly to force a showdown over voting rights, congressional Democrats plan to pursue a procedural shortcut to bring up stalled legislation for debate and try to win its approval over deep Republican resistance. In a memo to Senate Democrats obtained by the New York Times, Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, the majority leader, on Wednesday laid out a new strategy intended to overcome at least one procedural obstacle erected by Republicans to prevent the Senate from even taking up the legislation. Under the plan, the House would package two major pieces of voting rights legislation being pushed by Democrats, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, insert them into an unrelated bill, and pass it. That would allow the bill to go to the Senate in what is known as a message, meaning a move to bring it up for debate in that chamber would not be subject to a filibuster, and the Democrats would not need to muster 60 votes to proceed. Taking advantage of this existing exception to the Senate's supermajority requirements will allow us to end the Republicans' ability to block debate on voting rights legislation, Schumer wrote in the memo. The Senate will finally debate voting rights legislation, and then every senator will be faced with a choice of whether or not to pass the legislation to protect our democracy. Republicans have blocked four previous attempts to bring up voting rights legislation in the Senate, using the filibuster each time and leaving Democrats, who lack the 60 votes needed to get past the tactic, grasping for a way to even debate what they call vital measures to preserve democracy. Even under the expedited process, the legislation could face another filibuster when Democrats try to close debate and bring it to a final vote. And Republicans have given every indication that they would try to block it. If they do, Democrats have said they are ready to try to change Senate rules, a move endorsed by President Joe Biden, who is scheduled to travel to Capitol Hill on Thursday to confer with Democrats on their strategy. It was unclear how quickly the House would act, but Schumer has set Monday's holiday for Martin Luther King Jr. as a deadline. The new approach came as Democrats increased efforts to persuade their colleagues holding out against forcing through a rules change to join them, calling new voting restrictions being imposed at the state level a threat to democracy. Biden's speech Tuesday in Atlanta, in which he compared opponents of the legislation to notorious Southern racists of the Jim Crow era, drew a stinging rebuke Wednesday from Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, the minority leader. "I've known, liked, and personally respected Joe Biden for many years," said McConnell, who said the president had reneged on his inaugural vow to try to unite the country. "I did not recognize the man at the podium yesterday." West Virginia. Manchin's choice on Build Back Better, support mine workers or mine owners, by Jonathan Weissman, The New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. For years, burly men in camouflage hunting jackets have been a constant presence in the Capitol Hill office of Senator Joe Manchin, their United Mine Workers logos giving away their mission to lobby not only for the interests of coal, but also on more personal matters such as pensions, health care, and funding to address black lung disease. So when the Miners Union and the West Virginia AFL-CIO came out last month with statements pleading for passage of President Joe Biden's Build Back Better Act, just hours after Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, said he was a no, the Capitol took notice. With the miners now officially on the opposite side of the mine owners, it signaled the escalation of a behind-the-scenes struggle centered on Manchin's home state to sway the bulking senator, whose skepticism about his party's marquee domestic policy measure has emerged as a potentially fatal impediment to its enactment. Though most of the attention to the fate of the social safety net and climate change bill has fixed on ideological divisions among Democrats over its largest provisions and overall costs, the battle underway over parochial issues in Manchin's state ultimately could matter more than the public pleas of liberal groups and relentless bargaining by Democratic leaders. "We urge Senator Manchin to revisit his opposition to this legislation and work with his colleagues to pass something that will help keep coal miners working and have a meaningful impact on our members, their families, and their communities," Cecil E. Roberts, president of the United Mine Workers of America, or UMWA, said in a statement just before Christmas. The far-reaching centerpiece of Biden's domestic agenda has passed the House, but with every Democratic senator needed to push it through the Senate, Manchin's opposition has stopped the bill in its tracks. At this point, the president and the lawmakers standing in his way cannot even agree on whether negotiations continue. Biden says they do, but Manchin says they do not. But the decision of the labor groups to come out forcefully in support of Build Back Better could be significant. Mine workers are likely to be more persuasive to Manchin than the progressive activists who kayaked to his houseboat at a Washington marina to harangue him, or the colleagues buttonholing him at Senate votes. "Joe Manchin grew up with coal miners," said Jonathan Cott, a former aide to the senator who still advises him. "His heart is with them, his sweat is with them, and in the end, Manchin will always be with the UMWA. But Manchin has long been allied with the coal industry. His own family has profited from waste coal from abandoned mines, which the Manchins sell to a polluting power plant in his home state. And Manchin has received more campaign donations from the oil, coal, and gas industries than any other senator in the current election cycle. For much of 2021, miners and mine owners were in sync on their skepticism of the Democrats' far-reaching social policy and climate change plan, fearing measures to hasten the economic transition from fossil fuels such as coal and natural gas to renewable sources such as wind and solar. But in the bill, Democrats included provisions dear to the unions of West Virginia, which have been watching employment in the coal industry diminish for years. Most pressing was an extension through 2025 of an excise tax paid by coal mine operators and protected for years by Manchin. The levy finances a trust fund that pays about 30,000 miners coping with black lung disease and their beneficiaries a little under $700 a month. Because Build Back Better did not pass last year, the tax was cut in half as of January 1st, pushing the struggling fund further into debt. The bill also includes top priorities for union leaders, such as stiff penalties for employers that block union organizing and collective bargaining. Beyond those provisions is the weightier matter in coal country, whether to shore up a polluting power source or transition the Appalachian economy away from coal. The bill includes industrial policies proposed by Manchin that would help wean the region away from fossil fuels, including $100 billion to aid manufacturers and $25 billion for advanced manufacturing outreach, with $4 billion of the outreach funding set aside for coal mining regions. A tax credit for energy investments includes a generous additional subsidy for those investments that flow to communities with oil and gas workers, a closed coal mine, or a shuttered coal-fired electricity generator. For years, coal miners and operators alike looked skeptically at such efforts. Miners rallied to Donald Trump's side in the 2016 campaign as he promised to bring their industry back, not replace it with clean energy. He did not keep that promise, and coal mining employment, which is at about 51,000 jobs when he took office, had fallen to a nadir of 39,000 by the time he was denied a second term. Union mining jobs with good pay, pensions, and health benefits have been replaced with low-wage work, if they have been replaced at all. The promise of renewable energy as a replacement has yielded little. Jobs installing solar panels or building wind turbines tend to disappear once a renewable energy facility is up and running, since such facilities require little ongoing labor. Jason Walsh, the executive director of the Blue Green Alliance, which has brought together labor and environmental groups to marshal support for initiatives such as Biden's domestic policy bill, said he did not fault miners for their doubts. But he pointed to active conversations about building a solar panel assembly plant in the Ohio Valley that would hire more than 2,000 union workers. Such projects could use a federal nudge. January 6th committee. McCarthy says he won't cooperate. By Farnoosh Amiri and Eric Tucker, The Associated Press, byline, Washington. The House panel investigating the U.S. Capitol insurrection requested an interview and records from House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy as it continues to seek firsthand details from members of Congress on former President Donald Trump's actions on the day hundreds of his supporters brutally beat police, stormed the building, and interrupted the certification of the 2020 election. McCarthy issued a statement Wednesday saying he would refuse to cooperate. He said the investigation was not legitimate and accused the panel of abuse of power. Mississippi Representative Benny Thompson, Democratic chairman of the panel, requested that McCarthy, a Republican from California, provide information to the 9-member panel regarding his conversations with Trump before, during, and after the riot. The request also seeks information about McCarthy's communications with former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows in the days before the attack. We also must learn about how the president's plans for January 6 came together and all the other ways he attempted to alter the results of the election, Thompson said in the letter. For example, in advance of January 6, you reportedly explained to Mark Meadows and the former president that objections to the certification of the electoral votes on January 6 was doomed to fail. Without his cooperation, it remains unclear whether the panel will be able to gain testimony from McCarthy or any other congressional allies of Trump. While the committee has considered subpoenaing fellow lawmakers, that would be an extraordinary move and could run up against legal and political challenges. Lawmakers are seeking a window into Trump's state of mind from an ally who has acknowledged repeated interactions with the then president. The committee also wants to question McCarthy about communications with Trump and White House staffers in the week after the violence, including a conversation with Trump that was reportedly heated. The committee acknowledged the sensitive and unusual nature of its request as it proposed a meeting with McCarthy on February 3rd or 4th. Opening day of General Assembly. Lawmakers say they will address housing costs, crime in session, by Saja Hindi and Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Colorado's legislative session started Wednesday under the shadow of a still critical pandemic and with party leaders primed to spend months debating how to apportion an historically flush state budget and make the state safer and more affordable. The parties identify many of the same pressing problems but present largely opposing ideas to address them. For the fourth straight year, however, Democrats control the state House and Senate plus the governor's office, so they can always claim final say if they want it. It's evident once again that the pandemic is one subject area with little common ground. The politicization of the pandemic was clear, as Democrats in both chambers donned masks and all but a couple of Republicans did not. Healthcare workers administered rapid virus tests outside the Capitol, and guests, unlike lawmakers, were required to mask up indoors. However, partitions between lawmakers' desks that were taken down at the end of last year's session did not go back up. Healthcare and public health will continue to guide many of the decisions we make in this building, House Speaker Alec Garnett of Denver said. Despite our exhaustion and fatigue, COVID has not relented yet. This is the final year for many term-limited staples of Colorado state politics, including Garnett, State President Leroy Garcia of Pueblo, Senate Minority Leader Chris Hulbert of Douglas County, and House Majority Leader Dania Escar of Pueblo. In their opening day speeches, Hulbert and House Minority Leader Hugh McKean of Loveland argued that Colorado has become less affordable and less safe, with students falling behind in their education. Hulbert promised that his caucus would bring forth bills to allow struggling Coloradans to deduct rent from their income taxes and to exempt food from state sales taxes. He said the caucus would bring a bill to hire more police officers and to fully pay off longstanding state debt to the public K-12 system. McKean pledged to fight for Coloradans' cost of living to go down by eliminating excessive taxes and fees and a return to the broken window theory of policing that puts an emphasis on all our laws, focusing bills on increased training and reporting for police. Arvada Police, man with knife shot and killed, by Jake Shapiro and Kiernan Nicholson, The Denver Post. A vehicle theft suspect who police say had a large knife is dead after he was shot by two Arvada officers early Wednesday. About 1:15 a.m., officers responded to the 5500 block of Newland Way on a report of suspicious activity in the area, police said in a news release. Two men were near a Ford F-350 pickup. When police officers arrived, one man fled on foot. The truck had been reported stolen several days ago. Officers chased the man who ran and confronted him. The suspect, identified as Kenneth Delton Hutchison, 37, brandished a knife and refused officers' orders to drop the weapon, the release said. Two officers fired at the suspect, and he was pronounced dead at the scene, police said. Two Arvada police officers have been put on administrative leave per department policy. They were not named Wednesday. The Jefferson County Critical Incident Response Team is investigating the case. Man falls under an RTD bus, dies, by Kiernan Nicholson, The Denver Post. A man got off an RTD bus on Wednesday morning in Aurora, collapsed, and fell under the bus, which pulled away. The man was pronounced dead at the scene, police said. The incident happened about 6:25 a.m. on East Colfax Avenue at Havana Street, according to a police news release. Emergency responders found the man suffering from apparent traumatic injuries at the scene, where he was pronounced dead. Investigators interviewed witnesses and found surveillance footage from the area determining that the man was struck by an RTD bus, police said. After reviewing the video footage, the man is seen exiting the rear doors of the bus. The man suffers what appears to be a medical issue, collapses to the ground, and falls under the bus, the release said. The bus, after passengers were done exiting and entering the bus, pulls away from the stop, not knowing that the man was underneath. The bus driver's name was not released. The victim will be identified by the Arapahoe County Coroner's Office. Weather. Data. Colorado had hottest 6 months in its history, by Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. The average temperature for the past 6 months is the hottest recorded in Colorado and the country as a whole, according to data released this week by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The next highest six-month average temperature peak in Colorado came during the 1930s Dust Bowl era, the data shows. Colorado and the rest of the country is unlikely to see an exact repeat of the Dust Bowl because we're able to manage the land better than during the 1930s, climatologist Becky Bollinger of Colorado State University said. But there are some similarities in the extreme temperatures, abnormally dry climate, and the dust storm that swept from Colorado to the Midwest last month. We are currently experiencing climate change, Bollinger said. It's not something that happens in the future. We have it happening now. The federal data shows that the average temperature in Colorado from July to December 2021 reached 53.4 degrees, more than a degree and a half warmer than the same six-month span in 2020. The next highest six-month average in Colorado came in 1933 at 52.1 degrees, the only other time in the state's record when that average exceeded 52 degrees, the data shows. Nationally, the six-month average hit 59.77 degrees last year, more than a full degree higher than during the same period in 2020, the data shows. The next closest peak nationally came in 2015, when the six-month average reached 59.32 degrees. The national July to December average has exceeded 59 degrees only in 1998, 2015, 2016, and last year. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.